We're going to get started, everyone. So welcome to this session on Fortress Australia and looking at the global refugee crisis. My name's Liz Walsh. I'll be chairing today, just figuring out some of the technological issues with PowerPoint and so on, and hopefully that works out. So I'll introduce some of our speakers. First up, we're going to have Umesh. Umesh is from the Tamil Refugee Council, and he's going to be sort of presenting on the situation facing Tamils. It's a really grave situation in terms of both, obviously, ongoing detention, but also threats of deportation. After Umesh, we'll hear from Taki, who's a Hazara refugee, about the specific situation facing Hazaras. He's also an organiser with the National Union of Workers as well, which are organising amongst sort of refugee communities, organising to defend their rights, give them a sense of collective power as well. And then finally we'll hear from JS, who's a member of Socialist Alternative, about sort of the broader political questions, what do Marxists say about racism, borders, and so on. But also, before we hear from anyone, I'd like to acknowledge that the event is taking place on stolen land, the land of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and we'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and express our solidarity with the ongoing struggle for self-determination. So, yeah, please make Umesh welcome.
Hello. My name is Umesh. I've been working with the Tamil Refugee Council, who's trying to organise Tamil refugees in Australia to fight for their rights and broader struggle for refugee rights in Australia. So I was just going to speak very briefly, just explain who the Tamils are, what the situation is in Australia, and also a little bit about the cooperation between the Sri Lankan government and the Australian government. So one of the largest groups of people arriving by boat in Australia have been Tamils. So the three largest countries for boat arrivals have been from Iran, Afghanistan, and Sri Lanka. And the overwhelming majority of the boat arrivals from Sri Lanka, presumably Tamils. So the Tamils started coming in 2009 in the wake of the military defeat of the LTTE, or the Tamil Tigers, who controlled the north and eastern parts of the island, which is now called State of Sri Lanka. It used to be called Ceylon. And so between 2002 and 2008, there was a formal peace process between the government of Sri Lanka and the LTTE. However, that broke down, and tragically, the LTTE was military defeated, and in the process they killed, deliberately targeted Tamil civilians, killing about 140,000. In the last few months. And so in the wake of that, many Tamils, particularly those who had links with the LTT, who had over a number of decades built up a de facto state, had got on boats to flee to seek asylum. So more than 8,000, I think that might be a conservative number, Tamils arrived in Australia by boat. The Sri Lankan government has claimed, in cooperation with Australia, that they have stopped 4,500 from leaving. So when the Tamil Sri Lankan boat arrivals started to peak in around 2012, the Australian government instituted a special process called enhanced screening, which meant they stopped any boats mid-sea and processed them, and then if they deemed them not to require Australia's protection, sent them straight back to Sri Lanka. So over 1,000 people were sent back under that process. And so that was only applied to Sri Lanka boat arrivals, but then in 2013 they started stopping all boats under this Operation Sovereign Borders policy. But even recently, I think the most recent report I saw was December last year, boat of 29 Sri Lankan boat arrivals boat arrived in Western Australia in a beach, and then they were put on a plane and sent back to Sri Lanka. So there are still boat arrivals coming from the state of Sri Lanka. So the Sri Lankan government and the Australian government have a very close relationship. The Australian PM called it the closest possible cooperation. So there are Australian Federal Police, Defence Force, Border Force personnel all stationed in Colombo and under the government of Sri Lanka, and they're actively cooperating with the Sri Lankan government to stop boat arrivals. So they'd spend around $2 million a year funding the Sri Lankan government's program. They donated patrol boats to the Sri Lankan Navy, and the Sri Lankan government didn't have a surveillance capacity or program for boat departures until the Australian government set it up. So how are these people being treated when they're returned? One example, a freedom information request was made and found that one returnee from Australia had complained of being seriously tortured, and the Australian Federal Police officer was in the same police building as that person was, but refused to go and see him. Recently, the Tamil Refugee Council was involved in a couple of cases you may have seen. There was a case of Santa Rubin earlier this year and attempts to stop his deportation. He's been returned and has now been put under constant surveillance. He's been visited by military intelligence numerous times, and he's no longer staying with his family because he fears it's not safe to do so. And in recent weeks, you may have seen the case of Priya and Nadesh in Buluwila. And it's been quite a massive response from the Buluwila community, and over 100,000 people have signed this petition. So Priya and Nadesh, they both came by boat 2012 and 2013. They met here and got married. They had two children. Nadesh was working in an abattoir in Buluwila. And then one day after Priya's bridging visa expired, and she had been told that it was still being processed and she was going to get a new one, the Border Force and Serco and the police raided their house at 5 a.m., gave them 10 minutes to pack up, put them on a van, flew them to Melbourne, and then from Melbourne they attempted to deport them. They've flown, somehow they got to Perth, they're on the plane, but at the last minute some legal advocates intervened saying that they've still got a case pending at the court, and managed to get them off the plane. So there are lots of Tamils in this situation. The new process for processing boat arrivals is called the fast track process, and in that appeals body called the Immigration Assessment Authority, 50% of the rejected cases are from Sri Lanka Tamils. So 1,300 people have been rejected in the last 2.5 years from the IAAA, and all those people will likely face deportation. So I'll just say a little bit about who the Tamils are. So the Tamils are one of the ethnic groups on the island. The largest ethnic group who's based in the south and southwest is the Sinhalese group. And their culture is associated with Buddhism, Sinhalese Buddhist civilization is the idea that's driving a lot of the persecution of the minorities on the island. So before independence from Britain in 1948, there was an agreement that, for example, that both Tamil and Sinhalese would become the official languages of the country. But as soon as the British left, they started discriminating against minorities. And so that process is continuing, and that was the process that the Tamil resistance was able to stop for a period. And now that they've been, now that Tamil Tigers have been defeated, the process where the whole island is seen as the homeland for the Sinhala Buddhist people is continuing, which means that in the Tamil majority areas in the north and east, there's a heavy military presence. More than two-thirds of the Sri Lankan military stationed in the northeast. In some parts of the northeast, there are two, for every two civilians, there's one military personnel. The military are like heavily involved in civilian life. They're trying to be, they're involved in preschools and schools and medical facilities, and there's an attempt to try and change the demographics of the northeast by bringing in settlers from the south. So this process is going on, and basically anyone who's opposing this process is seen as a threat to the agenda of the state. And last 2 weeks ago, there was a state of emergency declared by the Sri Lankan government for the first time for about 10 years. And in that case, another group, which is a Muslim group, was attacked. Because they're now seen as a threat to the Sinhala Buddhist agenda. Anyway, I'll leave my comments here.
Thanks so much. If you want to learn a bit more about the history of the Tamil struggle, both for civil rights and then the struggle for independence, and then the situation now in Sri Lanka, there's going to be a whole session dedicated to that, and that's happening tomorrow at 11:30. And it's, yeah, going to be a pretty impressive session. It's going to have people who were both former combatants of the Tigers, as well as a video link, I believe, with someone who's part of the like a Trotskyist organisation in Sri Lanka as well, who are part of sort of organising solidarity with Tamils and opposing the Sinhalese chauvinism. So it'll be quite a fascinating session. Really encourage people to come to that. And also, yeah, ask questions at the end. Umesh has been doing quite a lot of research about you know, the situation facing Tamils in Australia. So yeah. Thanks. Okay, well now we're going to have Taki. As I said earlier, Taki is a Hazara refugee, quite involved in organising in the community, a famous singer as well, and we maybe if you're friends with Taki on Facebook, you can see it's they're huge audiences, much bigger than here. Yeah, hundreds of people, but also a really impressive organizer amongst farm workers. So Taki's got a presentation, I believe. And we
I'm not a professional speaker. Thanks, Liz and all her friends that they give me this opportunity, give me this time. I want to try to share some information about my community in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Australia. So, as you can see, there are two pictures. One of them is from the Bamiyan province, one of the main state of Hazara people in Afghanistan. And the second one is the girls and boys, they came to Australia. There's a big change, and they, at the moment they're living in Australia. One of them is my sister-in-law. She's she just finished her double master in politics and diplomacy, and she's living in Canberra at the moment. So the difference, the purpose of my speech is first of all to introduce Hazara. Hazara people are the third biggest minority in Afghanistan. They have been persecuted in Afghanistan since 1880 century, and everyone know, King Abdurrahman King Abdurrahman, he killed 62% of the population of Israel. It was the big genocide in South country, Asian countries, by the help of British government at that time. And they did several attacks on the central of Afghanistan where Hazara people were living. And thousands of Hazara, they moved to Iran, they moved to Pakistan, and thousands of Hazara, they moved to Syria, Iraq. Still they are living there without any identity. In Iran, city of Mashhad, like thousands of Hazara living, they don't have rights to buy a property, they don't have rights to start business on their own name. Like Hazaras buying house, if they have any good Iranian friends and they have trust, they're going, they buy house by on the behalf of her name and their name. So they don't have, they're not allowed to buy a house by on his own name. So this is a big discrimination against my people. And the big number of Hazara people at the time when Abdurrahman did persecution, Hazaras, they moved to Pakistan. The Hazaras in Pakistan, they are local, they have rights to participate in election, they can go to school, they can buy a house as a normal citizen in Pakistan. But since 1999, from that time, Hazara people in Quetta city, they are facing a big target killing and discrimination. There were several bomb blasts, one of the attack happened in Quetta. This is the photo of after bomb blast, like just 10-minute walk far from my mom's house. They used 1,000 kg explosion. They put it in the water tank and they bring it blast in front of a school and shopkeepers. More than 100 children, women, they have been killed in Pakistan. It was in 2013. From 1999, since now, every day there are target killing, bomb blast in Quetta city of Pakistan. So because of this, thousands of Hazara, they left, sell their house and property in Quetta, and they try to come to Australia. Around 800 people, they died on the ocean on the way come to Australia. And thousands of Hazaras come to Australia and they're living still in Australia. So at the moment, I have another list, attack in Kabul in 2016. This is the figure, like only in 2016, this is the capital city of Afghanistan. This attack happened on Hazara community. If someone wants, I can give the news link as well on my Facebook page. So. In each attack, 69, 79, 49, 32 people have been killed in Kabul city. And this is the biggest attacks in Kabul. But in 2017, there are four. I was trying to make a list as well, but because of the time. So 463 people have killed in Kabul in several attacks on mosque and in cultural events, this kind of things. So 463 people have been killed last year in 2017, only in Kabul province. This is the main state of Afghanistan. So in the other parts of Afghanistan, especially in central areas of Afghanistan, there is no law, there is nothing for... every day there is kidnapping the people and arresting the people, and government is doing nothing. As everyone know, in 2016-17, Afghan government is the most corrupt government in the world. So how they can protect the people, how they can save the people? They cannot do anything. But it's still Australian government want to send Hazara migrant back to Afghanistan. Even their life is not safe in Afghanistan. Even they are not safe in Pakistan. About Quetta City, like a few months ago, Human Rights Commission, they released a report. They said at the during of this few years, there are 564 something people have been targeted by target killing in Quetta City. We are a very small community in Quetta, like 600,000 people living in Quetta, Hazara people. So at the moment, they are surrounding by the security forces. Even if Hazara want to go to the middle of the city to buy a food or to go for education for any normal daily reason, so they need to go to get permission from the security forces. So who can say this is, how can we imagine this is a life? And everyone is, many people there, they have mentally problem at the moment because they're all under pressure, they are under threat, they're all under the pressure in Quetta City. So there is two famous suburb in Quetta City, Hazara Town and Alamdar Road. So these two areas are totally surrounded by security forces. And they're not, no one can come inside, no one can go outside. If any Hazara want to travel for any emergency thing, they need to go to get permission from the government's responsible person. So it's very difficult time for the people in Quetta. And maybe you can do more research in, on the internet, on YouTube as well. One of the biggest terrorist person from Lashkar-e-Jangawi, he came to the Mizan Chowk, and there is a big, in the central of the city of Quetta, he did a big rally, and he announced that in my last attack, I did more than 100 people I killed, and the security forces are protecting him. And they are not doing any action. Still, this person is living freely in everywhere. And at the during of 1999 till now, there are more than 800 attacks happen on the Hazara community, but no one have been arrested there. So at the moment, hundreds of those people from Quetta, they left their homeland and they come here in Australia, and they are on breaching visa. This is also another kind of genocide of my people in Australia. I'm visiting, as a union official, I'm visiting workers in Meljora, Bendigo, and Shepparton. When I'm talking with the people, all of them have mental issues at the moment. They have in a big pressure. They are in a big problem at the moment. So what is human right? What is human being? Why we not taking any action against this big discrimination? My people cannot stay in Pakistan. They cannot live in Afghanistan. And when they're coming, hundreds lost their life on the way to Australia. Hundreds lost their life when they go to Europe on the Mediterranean Ocean. Hundreds of Hazara lost their life on the way to Europe. So at the moment, around 5,000 Hazara migrants are on bridging visa in Australia. Close to 4,000 to 5,000 people are waiting for their citizenship, and Australian government stopped their citizenship. I'm also one of them. I passed my citizenship in 2015. Still, I haven't get my test, my citizenship. I'm paying tax. I'm working. I'm as a normal citizen. I'm working, but I don't have right to go to university. I don't have right to send my son to university. So this is the situation of Hazara people in Australia. And I become a bit emotional. So this is Shukriya Tabassum, 9-year-old girl In 2016, she came from Pakistan on the during of her school holiday. She was kidnapped by the some people. We don't know. The government said they are ISIS and they are Taliban. I'm not sure who are they. But this girl with her 70-year-old mom, grandmother, and six other people, they have been kidnapped, and they were on the hand of terrorists since 2-3 months. And we did a lot of protest. We asked the government to do something to release these people, and the government did nothing for them. And this girl was beheaded by the terrorists, and they sent their dead body without her head, and they sent her to us. And this makes people very upset. As you know, in 2016, by the name of Tabassum, there was a big movement come among the civilized people in Afghanistan. Like nearly 1 million people come on the road, and they took the body of Tabassum, and they come to the parliament of Afghanistan. They come from other province to the central of Afghanistan, and they said we want justice for this, but nothing happened, and still no one know who killed Tabassum. So and there is another story which I want to share with all of you. So as you can see, these two cute kids, so sister and brother. Her sister, she came from Iran in 2015 or something. When she came from Iran, on the way, she was also with her mom and 13 other Hazara passengers on the bus. But the terrorists come and identify Hazara, and the get them out off the bus, and they kill them one by one. And this comes on the news everywhere. But the international media, they're not giving any coverage for my people. So my people only can use social media. So by the help of social media, we can communicate with each other. They're like international media, they never did give any coverage for my people. So now this his brother is living without her sister, without her mother. This guy lost her mom and her sister on the way coming to Pakistan back from Iran. So this kind of hundreds of story we have in our community. So this is the bad situation for my people. And so the last thing I want to tell you. I want to request from everyone, every civilized people in Australia, please raise your voice for the migrant people. No one want to left their home without any reason. When they're moving from his house and they're trying to go to somewhere else, there is something. I came by boat in Australia. There was 99% risk. I was 7 days and 7 nights on the boat from Indonesia to Australia. At the last night, I was 100% sure that this is last moment of my life. And then there was a big hole at one side of the boat, and I just go inside of the hole. I try to sleep. I said, if I die in my dream, no problem. But still, I came to Australia, but many people lost their lives like this. Why we left our homeland? Why are we coming to the other country? We want peace, we want justice, we want safe life. So we don't, in Afghanistan as well, 99% of Hazaras are going to school nowadays if they have opportunity. I will, this is the condition of the school in Afghanistan. People don't have a school, but still they're sitting in the open area. They're trying to get education. They are civilized people. And they, at the moment we get big genocide in Afghanistan, but still Pashtun people, Tajik people, we said they are my brother, they are my sister. We want them come join us and to improve the peace process. The way which you following, this is wrong. This is not good for everyone. The only way which we following, this is peace and education, and just That's why my... Can you see this woman has... She has a baby on her hand as well, but still last week she came on the news as well. She has 3 kids, but and she is living in a very far distance in a countryside, but now she is doing her bachelor. So this is amazing. We have hundreds of this kind of story in my country for my people. Only that the one thing I say, Hazara people are peaceful people. We are not nationalist, we are not racist. We want peace, equality, justice for everyone, not only for Hazara. Thank you so much.
Sunday at 4 o'clock, there's going to be a panel session on organising farm workers today, the really incredible work that the National Union of Workers, all the refugee organisers and the farm workers themselves are doing in terms of coming up against the big giants of the food industry, the hyper-exploitation that farm workers face. So they're going to be talking about their own experience as workers in the industry and then also how they've gone about unionising it. A big part of the refugee story is not just a question of seeing refugees as victims, but actually as agents in the struggle against their own oppression and for a better society for all of us. So it will be an absolute highlight going along to see that panel. So our last speaker is Jayesh, a member of Socialist Alternative. He's active in the Sydney branch, and he's going to give us a bit more of a political framework, a Marxist case for why we're for a world without borders.
Cool. Well, the first thing I think I should say is what an honour it is to share a panel with these two fighters for liberation and human rights. Those stories were truly stirring, and it's really incredible that you're here, and thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. So as Liz said, I want to go a bit more broader scheme and talk about the kind of edifice of border protection, borders, and more wider, the capitalist system, which is responsible for violence and death on a horrific scale the world over. If we think of the case in Europe, where refugees from the Middle East are attempting to escape over a decade and a half of bombardment and warfare, for which the West has a large stake of responsibility, if these people are not caught in barbed wire on land, then thousands, as Tucky said, have drowned or are washed ashore on Mediterranean beaches. To add insult to injury, in the name of protecting European borders, European warships are deployed in order to threaten and deter refugees making the journey on leaky boats to force them to go back or into other detention centres in North Africa. If we think about Australia, home of one of the most vicious border protection regimes, one of mandatory detention and boat turnbacks, Australia's policies are in fact an envy of the neo-Nazi far right throughout Europe. Recently, Peter Dutton in the Home Affairs Office, as was mentioned earlier, had fought tooth and nail to deny a suicidal 10-year-old boy on Nauru from getting medical treatment in Australia. He had fled from Iran and arrived in Nauru in 2013, refugee status was granted to him in 2014, and at 10 years old, he has still spent half of his life in that hellhole. If we think about the Dawn raids on that Tamil family, Priya, Nadez, and their two children in the regional Queensland town of Bilawila, if it wasn't for a 13-hour court injunction, but really before that, if it wasn't for now 100,000 people who have signed a petition and uproar generally in society, then these people would have been deported back to some of the horrors that were spoken about by Umesh. The Australian government, furthermore, has spent $10 billion since 2013 on border protection related to maintaining the offshore concentration camps. And in the case of the now-closed Manus Island, it was responsible for killing more refugees than it had resettled. Both Labor and Liberal Party politicians have used refugees as political footballs to carve out electoral goals on the basis of whipping up more hysteria about refugees and being tough on borders. Furthermore, there are millions of people around the world who are denied rights of movement, legal protections, work and citizenship rights, and not just for refugees, but for migrant workers as well, who often have the same threats of deportation constantly looming over their heads. These are just a few examples of how borders wreak havoc on ordinary people every day. So what I want to do in this talk is I want to explain why the ruling class spends billions of dollars to militarise and control borders, and I want to look at how the construction and maintenance of borders underpins their rule by stoking divisions in society. And I want to end on why working class people should oppose a society that requires borders and a fight for be convinced of a fight for a world where borders are no longer a reality. So the first thing to say is that although borders are generally seen as these natural, eternal outlines of country boundaries, we have to look a bit deeper to be able to unpack how our rulers see them. And key arms of the Australian state agree. The Australian Border Force puts it like this on their website. "We consider the border not to be a purely physical barrier separating nation states, but a complex continuum stretching offshore and onshore, including the overseas, maritime, physical border, and the domestic dimension of the border." I think this kind of language of seeing it as a complex continuum stretching externally and to the domestic dimension is something worth keeping in mind as we go through this. But put more plainly, borders are a social construction. They are artificially drawn and redrawn by the rich and powerful in their own interests. And it comes in order to grab assets, to regulate the flows of commodities, to divide people, and to exert social control. If we think of Australia's borders, prior to the invasion of this country, there was a diverse setup within the landscape based on pre-class Aboriginal society. But the expansive drive of capitalism drove the British here to expand their markets, foster another centre of accumulation or profiteering, and to expand their sphere of influence. This necessitated the genocide of Aboriginal people and anti-Aboriginal racism to justify it. And as they sought to drive Aboriginal people off their land, they formed no-go zones for Aboriginals, criminalising and repressing their movement. This puts borders in a context where we can see their social construction linked to the needs of capitalism. Furthermore, the establishment of Australian capitalism as a colonial outpost far away from Europe with a desire to dominate the region while surrounded by larger populated Asian nations enhanced the importance of identifying with European racial superiority. The White Australia policy is a clear example of how Australian nationalism is rooted in racial superiority and the need to regulate the flow of other supposedly subversive or backward people. This racist logic has adapted through the years in line with the changing needs of capitalism. Whether it was the Irish convicts or labourers from South Pacific Islands, war-torn Southern European migrants or Southeast Asian migrants, their stories are all inseparable from the racism of the Australian state in this country. Today, however, the West's ongoing wars in the Middle East make Muslim people one of the main targets of this type of racism. What I mentioned earlier in the beginning of my talk only scratches the surface of what they have suffered globally. We've seen report after report here of refugees being treated worse than animals in the camps. And it has necessitated our leaders whipping up Islamophobic fear-mongering in order to justify that. In recent times, we've seen open throwbacks to the White Australia policy, though. Peter Dutton, who tried but recently failed to apply an English language test, the citizenship test, is a throwback very clearly to the White Australia policy. But also, I think everyone has come across now the ridiculous sob story about the supposed oppression of specifically white South African farmers in a country where white supremacy was enshrined in law. But this reflects a growing trend around the world where parties of the centre are adopting policies of the far right. This process is getting worse and capitalism is getting more brutal. The election of Donald Trump, I think, is emblematic of this. It sets a new low standard for our rulers trying to assert social control using racism and nationalism under the guise of border protection. You think of Trump's first Muslim ban in January 2017, where a blanket ban was applied on 7 majority Muslim nations. This was seen as an escalation from the Bush and Obama years even. Never mind that no one from these countries ever committed a terrorist attack on the US, the executive order tarred all people from this country as terrorists. On the other hand, however, the US government has crossed many borders and either intervened or bombed each of these countries in order to exert their own sort of, to prop up their own interests. These are, of course, not deemed terror attacks, but every person from these majority Muslim countries can be tarred with a terrorist brush. This comparison reveals the lies they've told us for years regarding terrorism, because who and who is not a terrorist or an illegal person is a selectively applied political definition used to dehumanise Muslims and other migrants whilst legitimising increasing state violence against them. Furthermore, Trump has ramped up the harassment of South American migrants. During his election campaign, the whole rhetoric of building the wall energised the racist base of the Republican Party. The truth is that the US-Mexico border is one of the most militarised. There are 18,000 Border Patrol guards who maintain the 2,000-mile border with hardcore military equipment and some of the most anti-human policies you could imagine. The migrant justice organisation called No More Deaths has found that the US Border Authority is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths spanning decades. The US Border Authority blames these deaths on people smugglers, where have we heard this stuff before? But since the 1990s, US border agents have been engaged in a policy where they chase migrants into the desert, scattering them across the Arizona desert in particular, leaving them injured or lost with no supplies. This border policy has existed under Clinton, Bush, and Obama, but under Trump, it's escalated further. It's given the green light to border authority to feel even more confident in whatever means they choose to brutalise migrants. And recently, the US Attorney's Office has been arresting members of No More Deaths just for speaking out or doing their advocacy work. Then there is his Immigration and Customs Enforcement attack dogs, otherwise known as ICE. They seek out to deport undocumented migrants, many of whom who have worked and lived in the United States for years. ICE agents under Trump have now been following undocumented migrants to hospitals, churches, shelters from the winter cold to put them on a register and deport them. Oscar and Irma Sanchez suffered this fate when they took their son Oscar to a children's hospital in Texas for surgery, and there are many more cases of this type of inhumanity. But this kind of increasing violence that I've gone through, I think, reflects a broader sense of instability and crisis in the system and a desire to reassert control. Connected to this is the backdrop of the global financial crisis of 10 years ago, which has precipitated greater social fragmentation and anxieties, and a political crisis the world over for parties of the centre. The political and business elite cannot seriously deal with questions about increasing inequality, poverty, or the gutting of public services. Instead, they seek scapegoats and the expansion of state powers to quell social upheaval. And this starts to get directly to what borders mean for working class people. Social control for the ruling class is definitely about divide and rule, but that still requires a sense of unity that binds one group artificially against other people in the population. And nationalism is the ideal sense of unity for them. Cultivating and reinforcing nationalism breeds a poisonous sense of racial superiority with the aim of binding workers to identify with their rulers. In 2016, for instance, Peter Dutton gave a TV interview where he's talking about how refugees will simultaneously come and steal our jobs and, of course, languish on welfare at the same time. It's horribly racist, but it's actually trying to tap into a part of the experience of working class life. That is competition for jobs, competition for resources, housing, etc. It's seeking to divide workers, of course, on these lines, but to identify with Peter Dutton and the repressive arms that are seeking to supposedly protect us from the other. Although I would argue that we have much more in common with the majority of migrants who ultimately come and form a part of the working class here, albeit on a hyper-exploited basis, they are treated very much like second-class citizens with limited legal rights. For instance, borders stretch into many workplaces every day, where bosses, if they can get away with it, employ people to do exactly the same work on three different wage rates: one for permanent residents or citizens, one for working visa holders, and the lowest rate for those without valid working visas. And of course, this pressure means downward pressure on wages for all workers. If you think about the migrant workers, the stories from 7-Eleven, people who suffered outright wage theft or had to go to the ATMs, take out money and give it back to their boss because they threatened them on the basis of their immigration status, or Domino's in recent times and Caltex, to name a few, have had many migrant workers suffer wage theft. And there's also going to be a session on Sunday at 4 p.m. talking about the oppression of obviously farm workers and the efforts to organise them, as was mentioned. Workplace discrimination based on visa status is a large and growing problem, and it's important to see that all these attacks on refugees and migrants coincide with increasing attacks on social services and wages. Racism is a strategy that is used to obscure the real enemy in society. But this is different for the bosses, though, because there are significant investor visas for people who want to invest $5 million or more, and you can bet the Australian Border Force or ICE is not coming after those people. And in fact, Australia, whilst it is renowned the world over for treating refugees like garbage, is actually the capital for in 2016 and 2017 for millionaire migration. And they recently tried to, they're recently flagging the high-tech skills and talent visa as well, which can be offered to people who would be paid over $180,000. So if you're rich or you're upper middle class, there's a different standard applied to you than there is to ordinary people fleeing persecution. These comparisons reveal who gets let in and who doesn't is very much a class question. But I want to wind up now, and I want to talk about the struggles that have happened against this logic and that start to undermine the logic of borders and racism. If we think back to Trump's Muslim ban, he was anticipating chaos, but I don't think he was anticipating the mass protests that ensued on many airports around America, which beat them back and freed people who were detained by his racist ban. In 2015, we also saw refugees from the Middle East launch impressive resistance against the militarized borders of Eastern Europe in particular. There were stirring battles in Hungary, where refugees lay down on tracks, on train tracks, refusing to go to Hungary's camps and demanded safe passage through into Europe. The Hungarian media called it a day of uprising, with hundreds of refugees breaking through police lines and asserting their humanity. This provoked greater solidarity throughout for ordinary people throughout Europe as well. In Austria, people ferried food, water and clothes to train stations to support refugees. Hundreds of Austrian railroad workers pledged to work overtime for free in order to drive special service trains for refugees to help them. And I want to finish on one particular struggle that happened a few years ago now in the United States, which was commonly called A Day Without an Immigrant. It occurred on May Day, the first of May 2006, and basically it was against the US Congress, who was trying to essentially pass a law that would criminalize many undocumented migrants, pretty much 11 million people in the population. In response, immigrant rights groups called a one-day strike, and colossal crowds, estimated in the millions, choked city after city as industries ground to a halt. The proposed law was quickly defeated in this rare but really impressive example of working class power. And one of the common slogans on the placards in the rallies was, "We didn't cross the border crossed us." And it was a reference to along California, Arizona, in Texas, New Mexico, cities like this which have had Spanish-speaking populations for decades, in actual fact, centuries, and until they were seized by the United States in the Mexico-US War in the mid-1800s. In the wake of this Day Without an Immigrant, one of the key organizers, Nativo Lopez, he was addressing a socialist conference in the United States. And as he said, "The value created by the worker is never denigrated, maligned, or declared as illegal. It is never accosted, arrested, interrogated, judged, or deported. Value never dies attempting to cross the desert. That which is produced by all workers, value, is embraced and appropriated by capital, but the workers themselves are maligned and denigrated." We must say that our cause is international, and that our class is one, the international working class, which knows no borders, and declare that the only thing that is illegal are the parasites who exploit workers, one which society can do without.